it is interesting to be at a conference that's talking primarily about the changes coming with the Affordable Care Act, and that we start with long-term care, which usually goes to the bottom of the pile. So thank you for that. The downside of it is I'm really excited about the Affordable Care Act, right? And I'm really excited that we're moving forward, a little anxious, but excited. And I'm going to give you another downer about current policy. So you're just going to have to forgive me in that regard. I'm going to shift from talking about the future of financing for long-term care, although Howard gave us a lot of background as well on how we're financing it, and zero in on a specific population who currently needs long-term care. And those are a sum of what we call the dual eligibles. Not a very felicitous name, but it's what we call people who are actually dually enrolled. They are both Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries. Only about 30% of that population actually needs long-term care, but they account for about three-quarters of the money that Medicaid spends on dual eligible. So they're only a share of the group, but an expensive share of that population. And it's important to remember that when we talk about the people who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, that they are a very mixed group. Sometimes it's assumed that they're all needing long-term care, all very expensive. Some of them do, and that's the population I want to focus on, but some of them are just poor, old, or disabled people, not disabled, poor old people, who don't need a lot of service and we don't spend a lot on them. So there's a distribution of costs and need even in this population. Let's focus in on the population that is the expensive population who does need a lot of care. In this group, they are eligible for Medicaid as well as Medicaid because they're poor or because they become poor when they need services. And they have both medical and needs and functional impairments. They need help with basic tasks of daily living, and that lead to a lot of expensive both healthcare services and personal assistance and other services. Now, it would be great, and that's kind of the tone that Howard gave to it, if people were working on this issue because of, we're all about improving care for this population, creating the kinds of coordination across different kinds of services in order to prevent the use of expensive services. And this population desperately needs that kind of help. But these people account for roughly a third of Medicare and Medicaid costs. They are expensive. The ones who need long-term care are expensive to both programs. And I don't think I'm going out on a limb here to tell you that I think the primary reason they're getting so much policy attention is because they're where the money is. All right. Now, we're going to hear a lot more, I think, about later in the morning and going into the afternoon, about the payment and delivery innovations that are so much a part of the Affordable Care Act. And I'm a card-carrying member of the supporters of those innovations. I'm looking at David Cutler, as we've written together on thinking about how these delivery reforms should go forward, right? You raising your fist there, good thing. Okay. That's all fine, but I have some considerable concern about, and which I'm going to share with you now, about the way this kind of payment and delivery reform is being handled for the dually eligible population. That now that they are, remember, a poor population, so the innovations for poor Medicare beneficiaries is being handled quite differently from the innovations for all Medicare beneficiaries, and we talk about equity. And in general, which we're going to hear more about, the accountable care organizations, medical homes, the whole array of innovations of new delivery arrangements being developed for the overall Medicare population, the approach to that is really quite cautious. The incentives are gentle. We have a tremendous reliance on shared savings. That means that if providers can develop, come together and develop a delivery arrangement and can, in providing services, spend less than they are projected to spend, then they keep a share of the savings and the program keeps a share of the savings. So that's kind of a gentle, kinder, gentler way to move that change in the system. They're also being done for relatively small population groups. They are not all, but many of them are pilots, but they are all pretty modest initiatives in size. The intention being that we should really test the concepts and see how they work and evaluate them, see how they do work, and when and if they do, then we expand them to broader populations. And that is the primary model of delivery reform in the Affordable Care Act. But when it comes to poor dual eligibles, that's not the approach that CMS is taking. As Howard mentioned, the approach, a very aggressive approach, is being led by CMS, working with states, and you talked about five states already have agreements. We have 20 or more states working on agreements with the state Medicaid programs, working on agreements with the federal government to do large-scale waiver programs. Not small, as Howard said, but hundreds of thousands of people, and they are not being put forward in the states as demonstrations. They are being put forward as transitions to a new model of care. The other thing that is quite different in the way they're going forward from the general approach to payment and delivery reform in the Affordable Care Act is, instead of these gentle financial incentives that if money is saved, if there are savings, then the providers receive a share of the reward, a reward, and the program does too, this model assumes savings up front. The arrangements that are being made with states is that they will get payments, or providers will get payments from Medicare and Medicaid that are cut from the get-go, and taking the savings out up front on the assumption that we will produce results and we will have better care at lower cost. Now, the reliance on this is relying heavily on managed care arrangements in the states, and states' Medicaid programs do have a great deal of experience with managed care. But that experience is with the healthy segment of the, generally healthy segment of the Medicaid population. It's with moms and kids. Neither Medicaid nor Medicare, which also has some managed care plans for disabled populations, neither one has much experience with this population. So essentially, in good tradition of economists, we're going to assume that the delivery system works, right? Take the money out up front and forge ahead and put this population in untested arrangements. Now, I think you can tell from my tone, I find that kind of a risky proposition, and risky in a variety of ways. It's the easiest way for these inexperienced plans to save money is to pull down provider payment rates. So these are Medicare beneficiaries, and these plans will now be controlling the use of Medicare services, so they can pay less to hospitals and docs. And they can limit, both in that way and in other ways, actually limit access to care. I know about the incentives to give better care, but they're all the same as the incentives to give less care. So this is a little problematic. At the same time, these arrangements, by treating Medicare beneficiaries or making them Medicaid beneficiaries, it threatens rights that Medicare beneficiaries have to open access to care. Low-income beneficiaries have those rights the same as higher-income beneficiaries, and these arrangements, as the law allows, pretty much override these protections, and on the grounds that the program is looking out for them. I find it particularly strange that this approach is going so forward so rapidly. strains from the federal perspective, because the services, although we believe, and there is some promising evidence, which I'll talk about, that by integrating health services, coordinating services, getting our doctors to talk to each other, there are improvements, significant improvements to be made in care, and potentially savings to be had. But the evidence and the expectation in terms of savings for dual eligible all comes from better managing their health care services. It's better managed. It's essentially keeping them out of the hospital through preventive and good primary and nursing care. It's not about good long-term care. Personal assistance may help with that, but that's not where anybody expects to see any savings. It's all on the hospital side or on the Medicare side, the side that Medicare pays for. And from a fiscal perspective, it seems to me that this is, again, odd that Medicare, which is where I'm going to go, that the federal government is not taking the lead. This slide shows you what portion of the spending on dual eligibles is federal and what portion is state. And you see that little pixel on the right of state spending is 20, that's coming from state revenue, state treasuries. Is 20% of the spending on dual eligibles is coming from states. 80% of the spending is coming from the federal government through a combination of Medicare, mostly Medicare, but also the federal dollars the dollars that federal government spends on Medicaid. So it seems odd that from a fiscal perspective as well as a delivery system perspective that the feds are turning this over to the states. Another reason I find it odd is that it is not only dual eligibles who need long-term care who can benefit from this coordination. There are about roughly an equal number of Medicare beneficiaries with higher incomes who have long-term care needs who could also benefit from better coordination of care. In fact, it is this population, the populations whose chronic conditions create a need for personal assistance and other services to support their daily living, they are the poster children for the possibility to achieve the promise of the ACA in terms of delivering better quality care at equal or lower cost. So, and if we're going to bend the cost curve, this is the population that you want to focus on because we can improve their care as well. And what I'm going to show you is that I think CMS is missing a real opportunity in not targeting their demonstrations on this population. The rhetoric behind much of the payment and delivery reforms talks about focusing on people with chronic conditions. But it is actually people whose chronic conditions create the need for long-term care who are the costliest Medicare beneficiaries and who could most benefit, who could get this better quality at lower cost. So I'm going to show that to you now. This slide distinguishes between people, Medicare beneficiaries with chronic conditions, and now I'm looking at Medicare beneficiaries, not just dual eligibles, and Medicare beneficiaries of all ages, so the younger disabled population as well as the older population. That it is the population with chronic conditions and functional impairments, the part of the bar at the top, the lightest color, they're the ones who account for a disproportionate share of spending, 15% accounting for 32% of spending. If instead you look just at people with chronic conditions, they are not the ones who are using so many services. This slide puts gives you a dollar perspective on this, what this disproportion is about. And you can see in the bar on the left that the people with chronic care needs and long-term care needs spend at least twice as much as other people with chronic conditions, and obviously vastly more than people without chronic conditions. This slide shows you that this relationship is, or that it's actually functional limitations, the impairments that create the need for personal care, that are driving costs no matter how many chronic conditions you have. So as you go from left to right, you can see it doesn't really matter. It's always the functional limitations that are driving spending. And here you can see that the result of this, the disproportionate spending by the people who need long-term care, is that they count for, on the far right, 61%. This population accounts for 61% of Medicare's highest spenders and about half of the top 20%. Where is the spending coming from? It's the places, when I said at the outset that it's the spending that we're talking about getting a handle on, or the hospital use of hospital services, and hopefully inappropriate use of service. I'm not hopefully inappropriate. I'll get to that because we can fix that. This shows you that it is the inpatient hospital services and the emergency departments, which comes when you don't have good primary or preventive care. And a little more detail here, you can see that the big dollars, the differential in spending for this population versus others, is coming from the hospital services, the skilled nursing facility services, and the home health services. So it's that those are not long-term care services. Those are services associated with an acute care stay. And so that's really the story. It's all about the hospital. Let me go back. We'll stay there. Okay, that's the end of that piece of the story. Now, I said this was good news, and so I told you I'd be optimistic. The good news is that we do have lots of evidence that this excessive or disproportionate or higher use of hospital and hospital-related services is actually preventable. The research that looks at the hospitalizations, now back particularly to the dual-eligible populations, so shows that when you look at conditions for which hospitalizations are regarded as unnecessary, if there is good primary and preventive care. So, and I need to look at my notes since I am not that kind of doctor. Hospitalizations for bed sores, for pressure ulcers, for diabetes, for UTIs, for pneumonia, all are believed to be preventable with good medical care, which this population is not getting. The rates of hospitalization are far higher for dual eligibles than for other Medicare beneficiaries. Now, there are a lot of skeptics about our ability to achieve the results that the ACA counts on or promises to really achieve the delivery reform that will prevent these kinds of unnecessary and expensive services, and by providing better coordinated care. And the skepticism comes from the fact that we've had a number of demonstrations and the results are not what we would like them to be, let me put it that way. But when you look at at the experience of those demonstrations, that one of the reasons that they are not producing results, or have not yet, is because the coordination services can be quite expensive. You have to invest in having good care managers and strong relationships between care managers and patients and their families, good access to services. It takes a change in the way medical care is actually practiced. So it takes a big investment. That investment is not costless. And if you provide those services to a population that really wasn't going to use those expensive services anyway, if your intervention is not well targeted, then you're going to end up spending more than you save, even if you reduce the service use by the most expensive population. So the challenge really is to target interventions to the population who you know is going to need services, and then you've got a real shot at having the savings from reducing those high bars, those high levels of hospital and post-hospital and emergency department use, reducing those levels and save more than you spent on the coordination. So my argument is that Medicare ought to be taking the lead in this effort, that they ought to be focusing their initiatives, at least some of them, a pilot directed to them, on people who need long-term care, coordinate the services across the full spectrum of care. For dual eligibles, those long-term services and supports will be paid for, but other people, that won't be the case. But that the families can use a lot of help in terms of managing the array of services they need to provide or arrange for disabled family members, and they ought to have this help as well and can benefit to it. And that, consequently, if Medicare takes the lead, we would be applying these innovations to the full population who needs long-term care, not just to the poorest among them. So we know that these promising, there are examples, as I said, if you look closely at some of the demonstrations that do exist around the country, you do find that within their broad population, there are groups who are benefiting. This is a population that can benefit. There are others, but this is one that clearly can, and that we ought to build on that experience. And that does not mean that Medicare can't work with states and Medicaid in terms of developing good services for this population. They can. But it is Medicare's responsibility to lead in taking care of this population. And I think that in abdicating that responsibility to the states, they are essentially throwing poor people under the bus. Thanks.